There was a time, not too long ago, when most everyone was a farmer. But then technology brought industrialization and scale. Today, very few farmers feed most all of the people. But that leads us to ask, who will feed us if technology fails us?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, there was a time, not too long ago, the grandparents had a big red barn on their farm. It was that big red barn was a pretty clear indication that it raised animals there. And in fact, you could find most all of the classic farm animals on that farm. Chickens, cows, ducks, geese, horses, pigs, and of course, dogs and cats. The farm had irrigated fields stretching up to the foothills of the Beartooth Mountains, in which one could see animals grazing in pastures and various plant crops growing in season. The farm also had an orchard of fruit trees and a huge kitchen garden. Though the grandparents never made much money with their farm, the men and women and sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters and nephews and nieces and cousins and friends and neighbors who thrived on that farm made them rich in a very special sort of way. Then, of course, things changed. Times brought all kinds of different new things to the farm, and especially the World Wars brought new kinds of technology to farming. And with those technologies, farmers learned how to farm with money instead of people. And most of all of the people then moved into town. When I last checked, the grandparents' big red barn had fallen in upon itself, and the farm's acreage was filled with government-subsidized sugar beets. There was not a person or animal to be seen anywhere. Thanks to the new technologies, one farmer can now grow 1,000 acres of crops with no insect or weed pests. Wow, truly amazing. And the cheap food made possible with those technologies allows us city people to spend our time shuffling binary digits of information from one computer to the next. That technology has allowed us for so much change in such a short period of time, just a couple of generations, leads one to wonder, what would happen if that technology were to somehow fail? What would happen, for example, if the weed killer glyphosate were to be found to be a human carcinogen and pulled off the market? That thought leads us to ask, who will grow our food if technology fails? Well, let's find out. We have somebody who can give us a good insight on that, and he would be Michael Foley, who is a farmer in Willits, California. He's also a professor of political science, though I think he's probably a little retired from that. He is also author of Farming for the Long Haul, Resilience and the Lost Art of Agricultural Inventiveness. I guess they're the same. Is if you have an incentive, you can be an inventive. Well, welcome to the food chain, Michael. Pleased to have you aboard.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Michael.
So, I'm really curious, of course, from political science professor to farmer. So one day you were sitting there in your professor chair and you thought, heck with this, I'm going to be a farmer or something like that, huh?
Well, there was something like that. I spent a whole political science conference in my hotel room reading farming books. But before I got to that and before I got to political science, I was fascinated by farms, by the farms that were disappearing around my hometown outside of St. Louis, Missouri, by the farms I visited, by my great aunt and uncle's ranch in Montana, where my father spent many, many boyhood afternoons. And when I got into political science, I got into it with the idea of studying agriculture, not in this country, but in other parts of the world. Ended up looking at both, but also spending a lot of time with peasants in Mexico and farmers in El Salvador and so on. So it was always there. It just got to the point where I had to do it instead of looking at it.
But why? Why would you study farmers in El Salvador instead of farmers in Missouri?
That's
I mean, it would seem if you're looking for real sexy stuff, that would probably be, you know, the new technologies coming into agriculture in the United States. And when you go to those developing nations, they, you know, live much closer to the land.
Yeah. I grew up in a revolutionary generation, and part of it was I was interested in revolution. Peasants have led revolutions in the 20th century, and many of those revolutions failed, and others succeeded, but not so well for the peasants. And so I was interested in that whole dynamic. Well, why do they happen? Why do peasants get so mad? They lend themselves to this sort of thing. Small farmers, when I say peasants. Why do small farmers get so mad? They lend themselves to this sort of thing. And eventually that brought me back to the United States and to the populist movement in the 19th century, when American small farmers got so mad, they rose up, organized themselves, created co-ops. The co-op movement of today was founded then, mostly by farmers, and even tried to form a political party and push aside the traditional Democrats and Republicans for something that was more favorable to farming.
Backing up just a little bit, why do farmers get so mad that they start a revolution? What is it
they get
about?
So mad. Well, they get so mad because civilization, urban societies have found ways to get as much out of farmers as possible and give as little back as possible. And, you know, you mentioned grandma and grandpa not making a lot of money. That's pretty typical. They feed the world, but they don't themselves get a lot out of it.
Not in terms of cash, you know, not in terms of cash did they get a lot out of it, but what a wonderful place to raise people. I always looked at their farm as a farm that raised people, and oh, by the way, once in a while they could sell a crop.
Exactly. And that's really the kind of farming that is going to get us through in the long haul. The cash economy is not. It's always been bad for farmers, or almost always. It's that human economy that's what works.
Then I still don't understand why they would get angry or so mad that they would start a revolution. Not that I probably wouldn't be there starting one with them had I the opportunity. Why would they? What is the grudge against city people? What is it?
Well, it's not so much against city people. In the case of the populists, it was against Eastern bankers with tight money policies that meant that credit was very expensive. And it was against the railroads and the buyers who were monopolists and could pretty much pay what they pleased for the farmers' crops. And there were people who were in debt year after year after year after year because they couldn't get out of it. So when you're in that kind of situation, not the one we're more familiar with, you can get pretty mad.
You're kind of up against the wall with no say in anything.
Right. Yeah.
And how is it that, you know, farmers used to be, everybody was a farmer not too many years ago. And then all of a sudden, this new technology came into play, and the technology allowed farmers to, in a very real sense, substitute money for people. You know, where we used to have people out in the fields, you know, hoeing weeds like myself, being a teenage herbicide, now we have chemicals. And you can borrow money from the bank, and you can go down and buy chemicals, and you don't need people. And so where we were all farmers at one time, all of these new technologies said, thank you very much. We don't need you anymore. Go into to the city where they have a job for you pushing binary digits around, and you can live happily ever after.
Or boom,
there you go. So we're now at this predicament where so many of us now rely on so few of us to produce so much. We're so reliant on so many different things. Where are we going to get all of these things if this technology kind of fails? So that's the subject today, really. Who will grow our food if technology fails? I think our guest, Michael Foley, might have an answer. And when we come back, we're going to talk about this predicament that we find ourselves in, where we're all almost totally reliant on just a few, very, very few people. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Michael Foley. He, the author of Farming for the Long, Long Haul. And I guess that's my kind of favorite kind of farmer, because you have to be doing a lot of different things. I'm reminiscent of F.H. King's Farmers of 40 Centuries. Right back.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it's a simple fact of nature, folks, that so many of us now live in the city, whereas we used to live in the country. We used to grow our own food, but we've all moved into the city, and now we're in this predicament where so many of us rely on so few of us for so much our survival. And it's an interesting predicament, because we're all reliant on these industrial food systems. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that as we move along here with Michael Foley, who is the author of Farming for the Long Haul. Because, Michael, this technology really did change the nature of agriculture and kind of the nature of ourselves as well. Because whereas we once were city people, or farmers, I should say, and we had to rely on our own ingenuity, inventiveness, as you say, resilience, now we have to rely on others for that. And when you look at that industrial system, it seems so magnificent on one hand, and yet so brittle on the other. So there's a good thing there, and it's kind of a scary thing too. But how did that industrial technology take over agriculture? What was that? What was the spark that really just allowed it to take over everything?
Well, I think it was cumulative, and it had to do as much with government policy as with technology. The new technologies allowed farmers to produce more, faster, and as you say, with fewer people. But that led to agricultural surpluses. And surpluses mean, you know, the law of supply and demand. They mean that the price goes down. And pretty soon farmers were struggling again, not being able to meet their costs because the price of their product had gone down. Government stepped in and provided subsidies. And that eventually, especially after the change in the character of the subsidies in the early 1970s, eventually encouraged farmers into a rat race where they produced more and more, created more and more surplus, price kept going down, they needed more subsidies to keep going, and along the way, farmers went bankrupt. They borrowed money to rent extra land, they borrowed money to buy big new machines. They borrowed money to use glyphosate and other agrochemicals. And when the price went down, when the price failed them, that was it for many of them. Millions of them went under. Mm-hmm.
How did it come to be that the smaller farms kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger?
Yeah. Well, part of it was that logic. When you can't make very much at all on a product, the one way to stay in the business is to make lots of it. So if, you know, you go from a profit margin of 30% to a profit margin of 1%, if you want to make the same amount of money, you've got to make a lot more product. And so there was that incentive to get bigger and bigger, or to get out.
Was kind of playing around with the research for my book Metro Farm, which is all about very small farmers and how the heck do you compete with very big farmers. I ran across, you know, ag economists who always said, look, dummy, It's all about the economies of scale.
Right.
And if you consider the economies of scale, let's see, Farmer Mike has 1,000 acres and Farmer Michael has 1 acre. And both go downtown to buy a $10,000 tractor one day. Well, it doesn't cost Farmer Mike much because he can spread those costs over 1,000 acres. Thus, the tractor only costs him 10 bucks. But poor Farmer Michael with 1 acre is going to have to spend a full $10,000 because he only has 1 acre. So economic principle of economies of scale kind of, well, I have to grow 1,000 acres so I can spread my costs over all of those acres.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then that kind of left small farmers going, well, what are we going to do? But I always think that the greatest advantage of economies of scale is that it allows the very, very big to be able to buy the government. You know, so if a donation to a politician costs $10,000, well, Farmer Mike's not, that's not bad. That's just 10 bucks an acre. But poor Farmer Michael, that's $10,000.
Yeah.
So I see this relationship becoming manifest in how subsidies are handed out by the federal government. Am I off base on that?
No, I don't think so. But it's not just the contributions to politicians. It's also the trade associations, the farmers associations. The big guys tend to dominate them because they provide most of the funding for those organizations.
There you go.
So, yeah.
So given their economies of scale, the big boys and girls, men and women, they have the advantage of competing. Now, that would seem to make it a real difficult situation for small farmers.
Right.
Okay.
There's a couple of ways we address that. One of them is that the smaller your acreage, the more productive it's going to be. That is, the more crops you can actually produce per square foot. And there's been study after study after study of this for like 300 years, the smaller farms just produce more per square foot. So that's one thing. Another thing is I have an acre and a half. I don't need that $10,000 tractor.
Good point, right? Won't even turn around,
It won't even turn around in my acreage. So there's a lot of inputs that I don't buy because I am so small that anybody who's larger, the larger you get, the more you need those bigger and more expensive technologies. So it ends up that my profit margins are very respectable compared to the profit margins of a huge farm, which could be as low as 1%. And in some cases, they're minus, you know, they're zero or less.
So it's very reminiscent of F.H. King's travels to China at the turn of the last century that he chronicled in Farmers of 40 Centuries, you know, goes to China to let the Chinese know about all of this marvelous technology that is coming out of the United States. Look what we are doing. But when he got there, he realized that none of this technology made any sense for a farmer who was supporting 20 people on a half acre of land.
Right. Yeah.
It just didn't make any sense. So when we come back, I would like to talk with Michael Foley, author of Farming for the Long Haul, about what happens when all of this marvelous technology we have, or what would happen should this technology break, it being so brittle, what would happen to us? What are we going to do? Who's going to feed us? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Michael Foley, author of Farming for the Long Haul. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these very important messages to talk about what happens should the technology break.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I was at a seminar the other night, and it was essentially a seminar on nutrition. And one of the attendees of the seminar was a small farmer, and the lecturer pointed out this farmer and talked about how he used to use all of these chemicals and probably was exposed to a lot of them. And he was at the seminar learning how to see if he could get rid of the toxins in his body and whatnot. But it occurred to me, and he is now an organic farmer, like Michael Foley, doing things as he think is the right way of doing them. But it struck me of a sudden, and I just held up my hand. I said, ladies and gentlemen, what would happen if glyphosate became illegal? And it was, you know, conventional farmers were no longer able to use these technologies to produce food. How valuable would this organic farmer's food be if the industrial agricultural model could not compete? It would change your life, would it not, Michael Foley?
It would. It would.
I mean, wouldn't people come from miles around to see if they could buy your food?
That's right, yeah. There would be a lot less of the industrial stuff available.
But in a real sense, I talked a little bit earlier about how the industrial technology seems on one side so powerful, so magnificently strong, that it can allow one farmer to grow 1,000 acres of crops with no bugs or weeds. I mean, incredible. But then on the other hand, here we see that this chemical that makes it possible might indeed be a human carcinogen. And now we see on television almost nightly, if you used Roundup, call us up and we'll sue this company and you'll make hundreds of millions of dollars. So that's a pretty brittle situation for industrial agriculture, is it not?
It is, yeah. It's, you know, it's also brittle in the sense that glyphosate has bred glyphosate-resistant weeds, so that farmers increasingly have to turn to other chemicals, other herbicides, or switch back and forth or use cocktails of herbicides to deal with it. And that just increases their expenses and increases their expenses. And that makes the system brittle as well. So either way, I think we're in for a reckoning. Industrial agriculture probably is not going to be able to serve us the way it has served us for these many years. And, you know, the fact is worldwide, 70 to 80% of the world is still fed by small farms. So we have to remember that, too. It's in the United States where we have, and to some extent Europe, where we have this this phenomenon of the huge farms with 1 or 2% of the population feeding everybody else.
So then let's talk about resilience.
Yeah, let's talk about resilience. What would that mean?
Yes, if our brittle technology, which is strong in some senses and weak in another, what happens if it breaks? How resilient would we be?
Yeah, we wouldn't be very resilient. I mean, we're building a local food movement, right? Local food has become everybody's mantra. And there's a lot happening. There's a lot happening here around me. I'm part of it in Little Willits and in Mendocino County. But it's still a tiny portion of the food that people in this town, in this county, in Northern California generally consume. And we're largely not ready. We'd have to generate millions of small farms to make up for larger farms that might not be able to serve us in the future.
That's a big order.
It is a big order, and it's especially difficult because we small farmers are competing with that industrial food system. Mm-hmm. So the supermarket can put stuff on the shelf that is often, not always, but often cheaper than what I can sell it for at farmers market. So that discourages small farmers from trying to serve their local communities. There's also a host of regulations that discourage that. You know, the dairy regulations in California have wiped out small
As have the meat packing rules and regulations.
That's right.
As has the a lot of the leafy green marketing agreement rules and regulations as to how you can grow things. And what about that bird that's flying over your field? Do you have nets to catch its poop? I mean, there are a lot of rules and regulations. And it seems to me, if you are a big operator, those rules and regulations would seem to really benefit you. But if you are a very tiny one.
Yeah. It is difficult to comply with some of the more extreme forms of the regulations. Some of the regulations are just about having clean hands and washing with clean water and so on and so forth. That's fine, and that's what we all want to do to produce for our friends and neighbors and our own families, of course. But yeah, some of them are over the top. And the dairy and the meat ones are counterproductive. We have milk on the store shelves that's not real milk. It's a processed commodity. We have meat from some of the most unsafe slaughter facilities you can imagine. And the regulations were meant to solve that problem, and instead we've got recurring problems with contaminated meat.
Okay, so then we, I think, are essentially up with a political problem here, and an economic one, as to how we can develop a more resilient agriculture with more smaller, more efficient farms. When there is a political establishment that's pretty much governed by money, and the money comes from the very big people. So where do we go from? Do we get mad and have a revolution, or what do we do? That's kind of where I'd like to pick up when we come back after this break here. But yes. So Michael Foley, farmer and professor of political science, author of Farming for the Long Haul, Resilience and the Lost Art of Agricultural Inventiveness. We used to live that way. I think of those small farmers who have to find their own way. There's no way for them. There's no book on how to grow farms where they're grow a farm where they're at. To do that, you have to be inventive, and you have to be resilient, and you have to be incredibly smart to be able to do this. And you have to recognize a different value system, and on and on. And above all, you're going to have to figure out how to deal with a government that essentially doesn't like you, because you do not supply as much money as your competitor. It's an amazing notion that government might not like small farmers, but that seems to be the way of it to me. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What with Michael Foley and you, right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, you are a political scientist, and you do teach political science. So how on earth can small farmers compete with big farmers in the agricultural field of Washington, D.C.? if you've ever been to Washington, D.C., folks, what dominates Washington, D.C. is the Department of Agriculture. I mean, you have the White House, and you have this, and you have, but the Department of Agriculture, wow. How do small farmers come to compete within the halls of the Department of Agriculture? Michael, you got any ideas?
Well, organization. I actually spent time teaching in Washington, D.C., so I sort of know the scene. But I don't know it as well as I should. But farmers have always organized. I would like to see us organizing around the principle that small is not only fresher, not only provides fresher food, but more nutritious food and inherently safer food. If you produce, not inevitably, but inherently, if you produce on a small scale, then, well, if your food's contaminated, you're not going to hurt as many people. Mm-hmm. You're much less likely, in fact, to hurt people because these large-scale contaminations, thousands of people eat that food, a couple dozen get sick. So think of the odds if you're serving 30 people. Mm-hmm. So small is inherently safer. I'd like to see that adopted as a principle by the bureaucracies and by the lawmakers. And if we could organize around something like that, instead of little dribs and drabs of subsidies for organic agriculture or...
When it comes to subsidies, I'm of the opinion that we should remove all the subsidies and see who produces the most efficiently without subsidies.
And you know who was with you with that? Ronald Reagan. Uh-huh. Ronald Reagan wanted to end the farm subsidy program, made a stab at it, and lost.
Yeah, because there's so much money being made that I suppose so.
Yeah.
So, Michael, it seems to me like the real battlefield is in Washington, D.C. On one side, you have very big businesses who can afford, who have the economies of scale to be able to wield influence in the halls of Congress and whatnot. They can afford to make those political donations. On the other hand, you have small farmers who don't have those economies of scale, but they have something else. They have the people who eat food. And, mm-hmm. you know, sooner or later, I think, and you see this happening all over the place, I think sooner or later, people who eat food are going to come to grips with the fact that, well, what is it that I'm eating here? What uh-huh. is it in this genetically modified soy plant that allows a farmer to grow 1,000 acres without weeds or pests? What is in this for me? And I think that is what the small people can fight with is public opinion. If they learn how to fight for that public opinion, what do you think?
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely right, and we've seen that, you know, growing awareness about the risks with genetically modified food, the nutritional deficiencies of industrial food, the problem with glyphosate, which, you know, some people have known about for decades, and now it's getting talked about. Now it's getting thrown out there for discussion.
Yeah, you could see it on television almost every night. If you've used glyphosate or Roundup herbicide, give us a call so we can sue this company and make millions of dollars for you.
Yeah.
I mean, that says a lot about what we're eating, does it not?
It does, and it's not just glyphosate, of course. The pesticide residues in food are regularly found to be higher than they're supposed to be. And even the standards on which those measurements are based assume that you're going to only eat one of those pesticides instead of a cocktail of them day after day after day. So, you know, people are becoming aware of that issue, of the connection between petrochemicals and cancer, and that's having an impact, but it's slow, and the political system resists.
Because that's where the money's at. You know,
that's where the money's at.
So to fight that money, you better bring something to the table, and some good solid reasoning and some good solid outreach to the community might go a long way to help small farmers stand up and compete in order, of course, to build a more resilient food chain, one that can withstand the shocks of maybe our technology coming to a place where it just breaks and something doesn't work. And it being so technologically precise, not something that's totally out of consideration. It could happen anywhere. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. When we get back with Michael Foley, author of Farming for the Long Haul, I'm going to ask him what he would like to see out there in the countryside and how it would relate to all of us city people who are batting about binary digits of information here on in our offices. This is the Food Chain, right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, we have just a few short minutes left, and so what we do want to do, of course, is to talk with Michael about what he sees, that what he would like to see in our food chain. I see him as a warrior. He's somebody who is fighting for this vision. What is the vision, Michael?
The vision is thousands of small farms surrounding not just our cities, but small communities like my own. I work with lots of young people who really want to farm. And the tragedy of farming today is that there are more young people starting farms than ever before, but many of them don't make it. Mm-hmm. So they need our support through education and training, but also community support, and they need access to land. Our town just got a $6 million grant to build a bike and footpath. With $6 million, we could buy a large part of the surrounding countryside and put small farmers on it on long-term leases and feed our community. I'd like to see that kind of thing happening. We're working on versions of it here in Willits and throughout Mendocino County and throughout California, so and the country. So I'm hopeful with all these young people interested in farming that we're going to begin to see more and more movement toward local, resilient food systems.
You know, in your book, Farming for the Long Haul, you talk about, excuse me, the need to survive. And when you start a farm, and I would think that one of the most important things would be to learn how to make money with your farm. So much effort is being put into how to farm right, but
right.
Got to figure out how to make money.
Exactly. And I don't want to ignore that. In fact, I teach classes at our little farmer training center, the School of Adaptive Agriculture, on taxes and record keeping and, you know, how to be better at making money. But the money economy is not all there is to it. Part of being part of a small community, of a community of farmers, is just depending on one another. I get most of my meat from fellow farmers in exchange for milk from our little backyard dairy and vegetables and and help on their farm.
Just like the grandparents' farm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's still happening.
Well, good. How do we get in touch with you up there in Willits? Say we're in Florida and we decide, you know, I'd really like to go to this school. How would they... So then, what is the name of your school?
It's the School of Adaptive Agriculture. Started out as the Grange Farm School, but it's now the School of Adaptive Agriculture. The website is adaptiveagriculture.org. Adaptive Agriculture, all one word, lowercase, .org. And folks can reach me at Foley, F-O-L-E-Y, .M-W. At gmail.com.
And there it is. So what fun. Enjoyed our brief sojourn into an alternative form of agriculture that we hope someday will accompany the industrial model, maybe side by side. And what I'd love to see is a good competition between the two with no big money hanging around Washington, D.C. Michael Foley, thank you so much for joining us. What fun.
Thank
this
you,
has
Michael,
been
for having me.
You bet. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, so remember, third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the food chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.